This is Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Iraqi President Saddam Hussein has ordered his parliament to hold an emergency session on last week's Security Council resolution calling for harsher weapons inspections in the oil-rich Middle Eastern nation. Arab League foreign ministers meeting Sunday in Egypt urged the Iraqi president to accept the resolution and told journalists they believe Hussein is ready to do so. Meanwhile, speaking on ABC this week, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice ridiculed the Iraqi leader's prospect of seeking parliament's advice as, quote, ludicrous, saying, "I'm surprised he's even bothering to go through this ploy," unquote. Britain's Defense Secretary Geoff Hoon sent similar signals yesterday when he told Sky News that his country was prepared for possible military action against Iraq should diplomatic efforts to disarm Saddam fail. WBAI's Sally O'Brien has more on Friday's Security Council resolution.
Holding Iraq in, quote, material breach of its obligations under previous resolutions, the UN Security Council Friday morning voted to afford it, in their words, final opportunity to comply with its disarmament obligations while setting up an enhanced inspection process for full and verified completion of disarmament protocols established in 1991. By unanimous adoption of Resolution 1441, the Council instructed the resumed inspections to begin within 45 days and also decided it would convene immediately upon receipt of any reports from inspection authorities that Iraq was interfering with their activities. The resolution contained a warning that Iraq would face, quote, serious consequences as a result of continued violations. But Brian Becker, spokesperson for International Answer, Act Now to Stop War and End Racism, says the resolution is designed to fail from its inception.
The new resolution has been crafted in a way that reveals that the Bush administration really wants the disarmament effort, if you want to call it that, to fail. It's a little bit like the Rambouillet Agreement before the war on Yugoslavia. So many conditions have been put in place that make it almost impossible for Iraq, if it chose to actually comply with this resolution, that the Bush administration knows full well that in the coming weeks or months, they will have the pretext they're looking for an all-out war of aggression against Iraq. For instance, part of the resolution calls for any Iraqi official, any Iraqi scientific personnel, to be withdrawn from the country with their families, regardless of whether they want to leave the country, and to be interviewed by U.S. or other weapons inspectors in any country that they so choose. For instance, that would allow the weapons inspectors to demand that Saddam Hussein himself leave Iraq and go to Guantanamo to be interrogated for what he might know about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. If the Iraqi government failed to comply with that demand, then the trigger would have been pulled and the war could start. So you can see by the language in the resolution that the demands are so vast, the demands are such an obvious negation of Iraq's sovereignty and independence, that eventually the U.S. will be able to create a provocation.
Under the new inspection regime established by the resolution, the United Nations Monitoring, Verification, and Inspection Commission, UNMOVIC, and the International Atomic Energy Agency would have, quote, immediate, unimpeded, unconditional, and unrestricted access to any sites or buildings in Iraq, including presidential sites. They would also have the right to remove or destroy any weapons or related items they found. The resolution was co-sponsored by the United States and Great Britain. Initially, France, China, and Russia had opposed a slightly different U.S. resolution, expressing concern that the U.S. draft contained, quote, hidden triggers that would serve as pretext for military aggression. For his part, U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan commended the Security Council, saying the resolution strengthened the cause of peace.
This is a time of trial for Iraq, for the United Nations, and for the world. How this crisis is resolved will affect greatly the course of peace and security in the coming years in the region and the world.
And that was UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. We have more in this report by UN Radio's Bisra Kostova.
UN Secretary General Kofi Annan welcomed the adoption of the Security Council resolution opening the way for the return of UN weapons inspectors to Iraq after a four-year absence.
Whenever the Council is united, it sends a very powerful signal, and I hope that Iraq will heed that signal.
U.S. Ambassador to the UN John Negroponte said the resolution confirms that Iraq is in violation of its disarmament obligations and gives it a final chance to disclose and destroy its weapons of mass destruction by cooperating with inspectors from the UN Monitoring, Verification and Inspection Commission and the International Atomic Energy Agency.
The resolution gives UNMOVIC and the IAEA a new, powerful mandate. Its core is immediate and unimpeded access to every site, including presidential and other sensitive sites, structure or vehicle they choose to inspect, and equally immediate and unimpeded access to people they wish to interview. In other words, anyone, anywhere, anytime.
The representative of the UK, Sir Jeremy Greenstock, said the new resolution gives the UN inspectors the powers that they lacked before to do their job effectively. During the negotiations of the text, France insisted that it include a guarantee that any failure of Iraq to comply with the resolution will be brought to the attention of the Security Council, which will then meet to decide on further measures. France's ambassador, Jean-David Levit, said he was satisfied with the outcome.
Cet objectif est atteint.
This objective has been attained. France welcomes the elimination from the resolution of all ambiguity on this point and the elimination of all automaticity.
Russia, which had expressed reservations that any new resolution is needed for the inspectors to proceed with their work, nevertheless also supported the resolution as a measure to achieve the peaceful disarmament of Iraq, Russia's ambassador Sergei Lavrov.
What is most important is that the resolution deflects the direct threat of war and opens up the road to further work in the interest of political and diplomatic settlement.
The text adopted by the Council demands that Iraq confirm within a week its intention to comply with the resolution. Reporting for UN Radio, I'm Bisera Kostova.
We believe that the UN resolution was the result of intense pressure by the United States on all members of the Security Council, who really did not, with the exception of Britain, support this resolution.
Again, Brian Becker of the International Answer Coalition.
They have succumbed either because of coercion or, more likely, bribery. It was and should be understood to be something of a commercial agreement between thieves before the commission of a great crime.
Up until this resolution was passed, Russia, France, and China had been considering putting forth a resolution of their own that was vastly different from the one that was, in fact, passed on Friday, because they were concerned that the resolution by the U.S. contained, in their words, quote, hidden triggers that would allow the U.S. to attack at any pretext. And what do you think changed their minds?
Well, Russia has a $6 or $7 billion debt with Iraq. That is money Iraq owes Russia. France undoubtedly has and has had for a long time, for the last 30 years, great interest in Iraq's oil developments. A very small number of Iraq's potential oil fields are even developed right now. And you can be sure that behind the scenes, Colin Powell and the U.S. representatives were offering to all the countries on the Security Council, but primarily the main imperialist countries, a piece of the pie in advance if they go along with the U.S. plan. This was the same kind of politics, behind-the-scenes deal-cutting, that has driven politics in the Middle East since World War I. The countries of the Middle East, Iraq, Syria, Jordan, all of them were the result of a secret treaty, the Sykes-Picot Treaty, signed between the British, the French, and France and Tsarist Russia in World War I. Its outside powers carving up the loot, the booty, for colonial domination. And we believe that's really what's going on here as well. We believe that after Iraq, there will be a focus on both Iran and North Korea, the other two countries identified by Bush as the so-called axis of evil. But no country is safe. Cuba is not safe. Venezuela, of course, is not safe. The United States government is seeking to carry out what they call regime change, which is to really insist on their right to violate and trample international law and put into place proxy or puppet governments wherever they see fit, particularly in those countries of the world that have vast natural resources.
There were people who were saying on Friday that the international community took a lead from the U.S. elections on Tuesday, and I'd like to hear your response to that.
Well, first of all, the Bush administration and the Democratic Party leadership in the name of Tom Daschle have proclaimed that the November 5th election was a mandate for Bush's war plan. We disagree completely. There was no mandate for war on November 5th. In fact, the issue of the war had been removed from the political agenda when the Democratic leadership shamelessly capitulated and endorsed the authorization for Bush to go to war at any time weeks before the election. They did this principally to be able to concentrate on what they said were economic issues, but the net effect of it was to ratify in advance this illegal war by the Bush administration. So when the voters went to the polls on Tuesday, with good reason, they could see very little difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. If the war issue had been put on the ballot explicitly, if people had been given a chance to vote yes or no to a new war against Iraq, a war for big oil, we believe that the majority sentiment would have voted no. In fact, that's why we have set up this People's Anti-War Referendum, the www.votenowar.org, and we expect to get millions of people from the United States and now from around the world who will register what we believe is the real grassroots opinion on this issue.
Brian Becker, spokesperson for International Answer, Act Now to Stop War and End Racism. And for Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Sally O'Brien.
As the Bush administration continues its discussion about the Iraqi threats of terrorism and its ownership of biological weapons, Reem Khatouda went to Columbus, Ohio, where Military Anthrax was created. She talked with Bob Farrakis, an investigative journalist who exposed Ohio's local research in the international sales of anthrax.
I was the investigative reporter for Columbus Alive. I'm also a political science professor at Columbus State, and I looked into the Battelle connection to anthrax after the 9/11 and then the anthrax scares.
And what did you discover?
What I found is that here in Columbus, Ohio, this is ground zero. This is anthrax central. The Battelle Memorial Institute had hired the former number two person in the Soviet biochemical system, the largest one in the world that had created all sorts of things like anthrax. They'd hired a man who was going by the name Ken Alibek, but his real name is Konstantin Alibekov. He works for Battelle as a consultant, and he owns his own business out of Washington now, out in Virginia, Hardin Biodiversity. And he thinks there's a growing field in selling vaccines. And Porton Downs, the British lab, made a fortune during the Gulf War by selling anthrax vaccine. It's a huge moneymaker. If someone, say, can send anthrax through the mail and scare the hell out of people, you can make quite literally billions of dollars selling these vaccines. And in the United States, there was only one vaccine makers, and that was out of Michigan, BioPort, former Michigan Department of Health facility. And oddly enough, it's owned by a mystery man who is said to be a front for the good bin Laden family. Also, Admiral Crow owns an interest in it. And these are, in fact, the people that have a monopoly on the anthrax vaccine in the United States. But what we know is that the anthrax was a trillion spores per gram. It was AIM strain. And there's only one country in the world that can make that quality of anthrax. The Russians could only get 500 million spores per gram. But that perfect militarized anthrax, that's made in the USA. And almost all of those facilities controlled all over the United States, from Dugwell to Battelle here at West Jefferson. That is U.S. grade A militarized anthrax. That's us. Yes, there's terrorism. Yes, there's biological agents about to attack us. But it was somebody in our own military scientific complex that sent that through the mail and sent it to our elected members of Congress, the Democratic Party, and sent it to the media in what has to be the greatest threat to democracy that we've ever had. Why aren't we talking about that terrorism? Why aren't we hunting down the people that tried to intimidate our senators and our democratic process by sending military-grade anthrax? It wasn't Saddam Hussein. It's somebody in the U.S. military-industrial complex.
And you said they made a fortune in the Gulf War.
Well, I think people should go online and do a search for Porton Down Labs. They're a Dr. Strange Lovian Institute, much like Battelle. that exists in the UK that actually prior to 9/11 was being investigated for killing 35 or so UK servicemen in strange experiments, which somehow got pushed out of the news with the 9/11 attacks. But they were actually being investigated for manslaughter and other charges. And this lab was also the one that accidentally sent Saddam Hussein anthrax strain during the 1980s when he was a U.S.-UK ally and when he was killing Iranian people. Also, just recently, Senator Byrd released information pointing out that a lot of the biological chemicals, the nasty various sort of botulism, the anthrax, were actually came from the West and given to Saddam Hussein. And in 1983, who is the man who brokered that deal? The liaison? A man by the name of Rumsfeld, who's now Secretary of Defense, was the liaison that went over and met with Saddam Hussein. And later we had this partnership, which included, from the Senate documents, giving biological weapons to the Iraqis.
Is this internationally illegal?
I think it clearly violates every international law. It violates a variety of treaties. But here's how they'll say it's not illegal. First of all, it was accidentally sent. Second of all, in the treaty, and this is how Patel gets away with it, in the treaty, you're allowed to have military-grade anthrax if you're creating a vaccine against other countries' military-grade anthrax. So there's this huge loophole. I can have the most deadly anthrax on earth, as Patel controls in the U.S. military, all I have to do is say it's for vaccine creation. And that's how we justify these huge, huge stockpiles of biological and chemical weapons. We say they're there to create vaccines. They're defensive for civilian use. But a lot of it is just, you know, crazy. When you end up sending that stuff, the Saddam Hussein, you knew perhaps what he was going to use it for. So in a lot of ways, our military-industrial complex in the U.S. is the real terrorist network. We're the ones that are using pawn third-world dictators to attack other people and giving them first-world massive weapons-grade anthrax and other evil, evil biological agents.
You said it was sent incidentally.
That's their cover, is that we accidentally sent anthrax to Saddam Hussein. I mean, that's what Porton Down Labs, and then they write a letter and say, could you please send it back? The reality is, you know, is that we feared pan-Islamic fundamentalism. Iraq was being used as a pawn of the Western forces, and that the reality was, I don't think anyone really believes it was sent accidentally. And if you look at what the document said, again, Senator Robert Byrd released just within the month, is that the same thing happened with the United States. Why did we send all these biological agents? The record reflects people in our military-industrial complex are, in fact, part of a terrorist network that uses and sends these agents out as needed.
Today, does he still have enough to really be a threat?
We don't know. We know Saddam Hussein was given a lot of nasty agents. I know what the CIA has said. The CIA says he really has no delivery system. That is, to attack the United States, you can't really bring it over in missiles or bombs because it blows up and it burns up up the biological agents, right? What the CIA suggests is two things, and this is why they've been opposing President Bush on the war. One, if he's got it, the only way it's of value is our troops go to him. If we invade Iraq, he can't get us. But if our troops go to him, he can get them. And here's the other thing they said, which was scarier, is that under what condition would Saddam Hussein give these biological chemical agents out to Al-Qaeda and enemies of the United States? And they said the only scenario we can think of, if he was trapped, cornered, about to be toppled, say from a U.S. invasion, under that circumstance is the only circumstance he'd give them to his enemies in Al-Qaeda, because he's going to fall anyway. So the reality is these Saddam's stockpile is no threat to us. We don't know how much he's got. And the only conceivable way it would be a threat is if we invade him, which is exactly what George W. Bush wants to do. And the only way to really unleash these agents on the world, we want to follow that exact scenario.
For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Reem Kathouda.
Since September 11th of last year, a political climate has developed in America where dissenting and disagreeing with the Bush administration's policies to wage war is sometimes risky business. Those who have summoned the courage to speak out have sometimes had to suffer harsh consequences. Among them is Troy Stewart, a senior at Marquette High School in Marquette, Michigan. He spent Monday in in-school suspension for expressing concerns about the impending war with Iraq at a recent school pep rally. We spoke to Troy's principal, Robert Anthony, earlier this afternoon to get his side of the story.
The situation is not a matter of freedom of speech. It was a matter of time and place. We were in a pep assembly, and the context of a pep assembly is, as it indicates, it's a rah-rah session, and that was the whole purpose of the session. It's a captive audience. Every student is scheduled to be in the gymnasium. And although the speech was well-written, well-spoken, it just wasn't the time and place.
It was very well-received, though. The students gave him a standing ovation, from what I understand.
Well, from probably what you heard, I'm not sure all students, you know, and I don't know how many because I was talking to him, but as I've listened to other students and faculty and parents, it wasn't everyone. In fact, one grade level, they didn't even know what was happening. But I do know, talking to some people, they were offended by it. Mm-hmm. Probably no more than if I had somebody from the Marine recruiter come up in front and talk, and people would be offended by that if you know, they were going to sensationalize the armed services. And we have to be careful what we say our freedoms, and especially in an assembly where you have some students who probably don't even know what the war in Iraq is all about.
Then we called Troy Stewart to get his response. Troy, you heard your principal say that it really was just a matter of you were giving the wrong speech at the pep rally. What's your reaction to that?
The letter that I got a couple of days before that was informing me that I had to give that speech had only a length requirement and had no other outline to it. So I saw it as a perfect time to inform the students of this possible war and to let them know that there are things they can do to try and stop it. And I've never really seen a place where peace is not allowed.
Not appropriate time to
not
speak about peace.
Yes.
He said many of the students there didn't even know about the war in Iraq, possibly.
Yes, that's actually probably the main reason I did it. At our high school, we don't even have one current events class or anything that studies current events. So I knew that probably 1,000 of the 1,500 kids in that gym had not a clue that we even had a situation with Iraq.
So you go to a high school that has no current events class?
Yes, not at all. The closest thing we have, I would say, is government, but we generally study other types of government,
mm-hmm.
and that's about it.
What did you say to the students in your speech?
I started off with a quote from Gandhi, and I told them that violence will only create more violence. I went on in this two-minute speech. After that, I told them that just inform them of the situation and what was going on that date. I then challenged the senior males, who are majority are 18 and will soon be 18, to think about what would happen to them and their family if they got sent to Iraq to fight this unjust war and possibly never to return back. I then told them that if they wanted any information whatsoever on trying to stop this war, that they should not be afraid to contact myself. And I closed with another Gandhi speech in saying that for this cause, I too am prepared to die, but for no cause will I be willing to kill.
What kind of reaction did you get from your fellow students?
After the speech, I got a standing ovation, and that was one of the major things that my mom brought up to the superintendent after I found out I was getting this punishment. She called to try and appeal to him, and he told her that Hitler also got standing ovations. And that almost made my mom break out into tears, believe it or not. So we were pretty upset about that.
Mm-hmm. Are political speeches normally made during the school's pep rallies?
No, they are not. It's normally the same old go football team, go dance team, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. So do you think the principal has a point when he says the pep rally was not the time or the place?
I think there is a possibility of a point, but because of the fact that in the letter that I got had no restrictions on it, that I cannot see how it was not a time or place.
Mm-hmm. And I'm certain that you raised your First Amendment rights to the principal and to the school superintendent. Yeah. What was his reaction to that, his response to that?
Well, we brought that up to him on the Monday after. My parents went in to talk to him in the office, and I had organized a sit-in with some of the students at school. And that happened, and it was great. I had so much support, and he agreed to take three other people besides me in his office to discuss the matter. And that was the first thing we brought up, was First Amendment. And he looked all four of us straight in the eye to notify us that when we walk through the doors of that school, our Bill of Rights are gone.
So your school is a no-rights zone.
Yes, pretty much.
I'm sure you were surprised to hear that.
Yes, I was shocked. I couldn't believe it, actually. I've had so many thoughts of just trying to get an independent study or any way of getting out of that school. But seeing how it is my senior year with one semester left, I'm going to try and stick it out.
Now, you received a standing ovation after your speech. Have any of those students or any of the teachers in the school stood up for you and your right to speak?
Yes. Right after it happened, the first time I was in the principal's office, he told me that the teachers and staff were appalled by what I did. And I didn't know what to think when he said that until I was sitting out in the waiting room to the office and had probably 80% of the staff come up to me and put their arm around me and look around to see if anybody's around and tell me that they don't care who knows it, but they believe in what I did. Hmm. And a lot of my teachers, actually, I've had some debates in our classes, and they've been talking about the war in Iraq a lot more now. And initially, that's exactly what I wanted to do.
So, to your knowledge, have any of the teachers actually confronted the administration there, particularly on its statement that once you walk through the schoolroom doors, the school building doors, that you have no rights?
No, actually, the media actually kind of went crazy on this deal up here, the local paper and radio stations and news. But the thing was, for a while, I didn't give out any statements or anything. And all they got was Mr. Anthony's side. So a lot of the people don't know about the references that were made with me and Hitler and some of the things about the Bill of Rights that that our principal said. And a lot of people are just misinformed about what has been going on at our school.
Mm-hmm. So just sort of summarize the legal battle. I know at one point the judge issued a restraining order.
Yes.
But then here you are today serving your first day of detention.
Yes. He served the restraining order the day of the sit-in, the day of my last soccer game as a soccer player. And that was to dissolve on its own by 14 days. And the 14th day was Monday. And on Tuesday, I was informed by the principal that despite growing support for not only my case, but generally First Amendment rights in general at our school, he decided to go ahead and still give me the ISS on today's date.
ISS being the in-school suspension.
Yes, in-school suspension, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. And at first, we were going to continue fighting it and bring it into the courts and do everything like that, but we realized how long it was going to take. Our lawyer informed us that it could take over 18 months to resolve. Mm-hmm. And with me graduating in 6-7 months, I decided that probably won't be such a great idea. And it's wasting a lot of time, and I realized that my agenda was not to fight the school. It was to fight the unjust war. And I'm getting back to my basis now to do that.
Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced by Scott Gurian. Our engineer today was Rolando Arrieta. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett at KPFA and Reem Kahuta of WPFW. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening.